Hello and welcome to Unidentified Wargamer. Each week I interview a wargamer and identify them in the hobby. This week I've got on the underrated himself, Karen Coates. How are you going?
Hey, doing well.
That's good to hear. Have you had a busy week then?
Busy week, yeah. We just finished up. Had a bit of a 10-day trip over in South Australia. So did the SAGT with my partner. So I thought while you're traveling over there, might as well enjoy the Barossa wineries and everything that South Australia's got to offer. And on the way back, did a stop by Grampians and the Dalesford Hot Springs, which, you know, there's definitely harder ways to live your life than doing that. But back to the regular grind now as such.
It sounds like a very cruisy week with a tournament in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly. I actually think in hindsight, the best way to do a Warhammer tournament is have a little holiday around it if you can. But understandably, you can't do that with every tournament for sure.
Do you find you generally get straight back into playing games, or you like to have a few weeks off after a tournament?
For me, I probably do take a few weeks off. For me personally, I almost play 95% of my games exclusively at tournaments. So I'm located in Melbourne CBD. So there's not actually a local club to Melbourne CBD for AOS. You do have Warplings, which I know there are a few players there, but it's sort of intermittently scattered. It's mainly 40K. Next closest clubs are actually about a 30-40 minute journey to get there and back. So I probably play 90-95% of my games at tournaments. And then just between tournaments, it's all just like theory stuff, maybe a TTS here or there. So in terms of taking a break between tournaments, that's all I do is take a break between tournaments and then get back into them and hope to God the meta hasn't changed on me too much between one tournament to the next.
Yeah, that's fair enough. How do you go about doing your theory crafting and sort of getting practice in with your list then if you're not playing a whole lot outside of tournaments?
Well, I guess for me, one thing that helps is I exclusively play Skaven.
That does help a lot.
That helps a ton. So I don't have to worry about a lot of different like this and that and up and down. Like I'm only having to remember one army, one thing. Within Skaven, there's a bunch of variability, which is handy. And that does let me change between tournaments and run very different lists while still keeping the same mechanisms in mind. So I'm not playing a new list. It's like, oh, I forgot to use that rule. It's like the rules are the same. It's just which units and what sort of composition is the thing that changes. So that, and look, there's plenty of nice, lots of Warhammer groups out there and chats that sort of help for what people are looking at in the meta, looking at the stats, when you look at the stats, you can kind of predict, okay, if that's what's happening in the world right now, this is probably what I'd expect in Australia. I always think in Australia, we like our, I call them beefy, but just like bruiser type lists. So whatever the rest of the world is doing with its fancy tech, just assume Australian lists are going to be like, just punch you in the face really hard, really hard and really fast. So keep that in mind.
Why we love destruction.
Yeah, we really do. Every time I go out to the Bendigo Ballarat side, I'm like, man, every list out here just wants to slap you in the face turn one. It's amazing.
Yep, that's fair enough. Yeah. The classic Australian scene.
Yeah, that's it. So that's the thing for me, is that it's not too hard to keep up with things. It's sticking with one army does help. Again, I know lots of people who do run 3, 4, 5 different armies. And the other thing is, while there are 17 armies in a meta, or 70, however many they are, 23, 25, something crazy, the reality is you only really need to keep track of the new ones, and more importantly, the new ones that are appearing to be predominantly strong, which really means in every new tournament I'm probably only having to study 3 or 4 new armies or lists to think, okay, this is like right now I didn't have to deal with OBR and Soulblight Gravelords in SAGT. They've now just had their FAQ, so for the next tournament coming up, that's the real thing I need to sort of study and go, okay, here's my old list, here's what I'm dealing with now, do I need to make any changes? And I try to not overcorrect for the meta, because it's very easy to be like, this is the new thing. Put all my eggs into this basket. And then you just get slapped by like everything that was good before that everyone's just forgotten about. And even in Australia, again, I know different parts of the world may be listening, but within Australia, even if something is like top of the meta, you probably only get 10 to 15% of players playing, because most people in Australia just play the one that they like the most. So even if something is dominant, you're still thinking that 85% of the meta is not the dominant thing that you need to factor in. Masters was a great example of that with, 14 different armies. Were they all top of the meta? Absolutely not, but you had to factor in that there was going to be a whole variety there as such.
And that's where you come up with those struggles of like, oh, you come against a Gargant list. Well, now I've ticked to come against these 120 zombies, or how do I deal with a Gargant list? Yeah, I know that was a big drama for a lot of people, because they're so kind of like opposites of what the lists do, that you can't go for either or, otherwise you just get slammed by the other.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, a lot of the best lists do sit somewhere in the middle with a high level of variability. So you like, it's not good into Gargants and it's not good into 120 zombies, but you at least have play and you can win if you are good enough and outplay the opponent rather than just being a wash, which just feels awful.
Yeah, so the mismatch is always a real like heartbreak when you go, oh, I've just lost this because I've ticked too hard the other way, and you weren't expecting to come up against a list like this, and you always find those stragglers out there, and then you come against them, and that's when you're sort of like, oh, okay.
Yeah, pretty much. I remember there was a tournament a while back. I predicted the meta would be all like, again, heavy bruisers, and I was correct. But then I happened to line up against five ranged magic gun lines for the tournament. Just even though there was not many of them, I just hit every single one of them, and that happened.
Do you have a little think tank for how you prepare for the current meta and upcoming metas?
Not like a huge think tank. I mean, just talking to my mates who are also in the same game, seeing what's out there. You know, you can kind of just look out there to see what everyone's complaining about as the big boogeyman of the time. There within the Skaven side, there are a few like more close-knit Skaven chats, which are probably the more useful ones, because when there's big changes in the rest of the stuff, Skaven doesn't necessarily follow the same changes as everything else. And there is, you know, I definitely have noticed that there are sort of Skaven think tanks and trends within Skaven itself, which is a really funny thing to think about, like that every like 3 months everyone's following a new type of thing. Like 3 months ago we're like, nah, this is crap, and like I mean for SAGT I ran some Doom Wheels, and now after running Doom Wheels everyone's trying out Doom Wheels, and they're like, shit, this is good. Like we've been sleeping on Doom Wheels the whole time.
It's been like over a year as well, and it's like the one unit that everyone sort of loves, so they're like their little pet unit, and yet no one had ran them to figure out that they were good enough to take somewhere.
Everyone's like, yeah, I love this thing and it's kind of good, but like not quite there. But like no one actually really put pedal to the metal and be like, well, what does it take to make this thing go there? Turns out it's pretty good. But we'll see how it continues as well. But yeah, lots of different changes. But just like I said, just like sort of more local messenger groups and stuff like that for and there are some Discord servers out there for Skaven, and that's probably what I mainly use. I do try to avoid, as I was saying before, try not to over tech for the meta. It's more important for you to think about the meta of your army. I know that sounds like a bit of a weird thing to say, but like, what is the best variant of your army, not what is the best thing out there for the meta of what everyone else is taking. Because the best way you can prepare is to have the best army of your type going against the best army of their type. If you're having to counter for their meta that they're looking to bring, you're probably on the back foot and you're already losing. And that's just, again, that's just not Warhammer, that's just everything.
And there's always the skill of, you know, your army inside and out, so you're not forgetting rules, and you know what your army can do, and then you're always trying to figure out what your opponent's trying to do, and you're trying to learn what they're capable of when you're not having to focus on your own army, which is a massive skill set.
For sure. Like I said, it was Skaven in particular. There's a lot of things to remember. You're playing in almost every single phase. You have to be on the entire time, so you really don't want to be missing key triggers or skipping things. You kind of just want to be like, I don't need to think about my army. I don't need to think about my roles. I don't need to look up the stats. I just know them, so that I can focus on the game. And you'll hit that key redeploy, or you'll see that key angle that you would have missed if you weren't, you know, focused on it at that particular time.
And how do you get like the memory going for someone that doesn't play a lot of like local games, just more tournament games? How do you get those reps in then?
How do you get the reps in? So I mean, in terms of getting the reps in, something I think that I see a lot of, I don't know what the best way to define this is, but people focus on the things that don't matter rather than the things that do. So you'll notice with a lot of good players, even though they're very, very good at the game and they're top of what they do, they still don't know everything. Like people think that I just have a picture perfect. Oh yeah, you're playing this army, they're three to hit, four to wound, whatever. Like I don't really care. Like I just need to know the big picture. Like they're a light damage unit that has two wounds on a medium save. Like what that specific number is doesn't matter. So I think where I'm saying a lot of that is, a lot of people get very washed out early on with AOS because there's this, there's that, you gotta remember that, blah 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 blah. And then what they end up doing is they gravitate to cheat sheets. So the problem with the cheat sheet is then they put every single little interaction on there. And the reality is 90% of a cheat sheet probably doesn't need to be there. You can be like, this is my key things on how I win the game. This is what I need to do, blah, 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 blah. And all the other stuff is like, if you can remember it, it's bonus, but otherwise it ends up being noise a lot of the time. So in terms of how to learn to remember, just remember the big things that you actually need. So you should know your army pretty well and just remember the big things about your army. And then for opponent's army, you just need to understand where are the deep strikers, what are the chaff, what's the hammer, what's the anvil, what's the caster. If they have a caster, what's the one spell that I need to actually care about, and the rest of them just let them go. So just almost having a very high level view of the game rather than getting too stuck in the weeds, it probably does help, because I think if you get stuck in the weeds, this game changes too fast, and no one gets paid enough to remember 22 armies
Yeah, that's
evolving
fair.
all the time. Like, no one's getting paid in this game. If you're getting paid, you need to learn everything in this game, but no one in this game's getting paid so far. So just remember your army very well and just the general vibe of what everything's trying to do.
I did like your idea of being able to throw things in categories. Like you come against the Slaves of Darkness army, you can be like, well, there's all my heavy cav, and they do this one thing. Well, then now you can sort of disregard all the rules around them and just focus on that's the two bits there, and you can move on to other bits of the army.
Varangard, they move fast, they're hard to kill, they can fight and activate twice, and for me specifically, they can run and charge. What the numbers on Varangard is, I don't know. I know that if they run into me, I'm going to die. It's that simple. And on top of that, I need to put almost everything to kill them. That's a good example of it, where you don't need to know all the specifics of all the weapon loadouts and everything that's going on. It's just the very basic high level stuff of each thing. It does make a difference.
And that's four basic dot points right there that you can very easily keep in your brain. And then you can focus on that unit. Oh, that's the unit over there that makes me fight last. So then watch out for that. And that makes it easy just to categorize the whole, like the army as a whole. You're not focusing on all these small minutiae, like you were saying.
Yeah, and then eventually you will get to a point where you play other armies and you go, oh, this is just that, but this. So you're not having to learn. Like, a bit of a weird version here would be, I think that the pigs from Iron Jaws are just Varangard, but they can move back at the end of the after fighting you. And if you just think of it like that, it's pretty much true. Like, they're still tanky, move fast, hit hard. Can do a double activate-y thing depending on what they're playing, but more importantly, instead of double activating forwards, they double activate back. So they're just a movement tech version of a Varangard. And so just, building up that core base and then being like, oh, it's just this. This is just, this is just sentinels that hit more for physical damage rather than mortals. Or this is just, sentinels, but I can't shoot them because they're IDK, sort of that level of build up.
I like that way of thinking. I could see it helping newer players wrap their head around this massive game that is Age of Sigmar.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And how did you get involved with being like in a competitive side of Warhammer?
In competitive Warhammer, so I've always, whatever, any gaming I've ever done, I've always been very competitive in it. So I used to play a ton of Dota, League. I played Magic back in sort of early, sort of uni, high school. And in terms of competitive AOSO, I used to play fantasy as a teenager. I did play competitively, but as most teenagers are, I wasn't very good. At the time, I thought I was the greatest Skaven player of all time. But in hindsight, looking back, I'm like, man, I was so bad. But then for me, in terms of getting into AOS, took about a 10-year break. I went back to my parents, and they wanted to throw out my. They're like, oh, I got these stupid rat things that we got here. And I was like, don't throw them out, like bring them back. Oh, so I brought them back to my place. And then I was like, I was going to sell them and thought, nah, I'm going to check out what's in the competitive scene. So, in terms of people wanting to sort of learn and get into the dive of it, my first full game was actually at a tournament. I went down to Warplings down the road, and I met a guy named Bill and Will, who were the two guys playing. And Bill was, lovely enough to say, oh, I've got a ticket to this one called Rumble in the Realms, which was a small little one day here. He had a ticket, he couldn't go, and I thought, hell, I'll take that ticket. So I still remember my first game being like, priority rolls, okay. So so how does this work? It's like IDK. Oh man, that I'm having to play IDK as my first game, which was very confusing as a first game. Like, what do you mean I can't do other things? What do you mean you're off the board? But yeah, so just I just got straight into it. In terms of getting into the competitive side, I think a big part of it is don't be afraid to just play a competitive game and lose. Like, you're gonna suck early on. If you like, just, it is what it is. But you don't get better by playing. You know, I think I used to call it, what, a seal clubbing back in the day, where you just
still is.
Okay, yeah, you don't get better by seal clubbing. Like, you need to play better players who are just gonna beat you. And at the end of the game, just ask them, what did I do wrong? What was your key things that you think I would have I should have done better? But yeah, that's sort of how I got. I got straight into the tournament side. And then I think I did the tournament there, then I had like one other game, then I did another GT, and then just kept doing tournaments.
I think the biggest thing against playing top level competitive players is, outside of the usual things of like iron sharpens iron and all that sort of stuff, you get to see like the small minutiae of their play style. Like, if you play against seals all the time, you might pick up some really bad habits of piling in or doing movement, where if you come up against a top player, they're better to show you these small little tips and tricks. Like, I'm sure you're well aware with your Skaven army, there's lots of little tricks you can do with pile-in movements that you wouldn't necessarily know or recognize if you're just playing the same people that are at this, like, a very low skill level.
For sure. I've got two examples of that in mind. One was at Snake Eyes last year. I was lucky enough to play against Michael Clark, who just beat the shit out of me. it was probably the single worst loss I've ever taken. He was playing Citizen Sigma, and I killed zero models, like zero. however, as a last ditch effort, I threw out, this is when Purple Sun was busted, I threw out Purple Sun, rolled a one on Krondas on the first roll and killed his Krondas. So I'm like, all right, got a Krondas on the way down. But and I remember he did some really funny movement tricks where how do I describe this? Like, he would move up his chaff in a way where he was leaving, he would move his archers up with the Soul Scream Bridge. Mm-hmm. And because they were just over it, just under an inch between them, he could then run his chaff line, which was 25 millimeter, through his archers to form a front line after tell. I was like, you can do that? Like, that's a thing. And it sort of got me thinking about some of the more advanced movement tricks. And, you know, the other guy, Will, who I was mentioning before, just has constantly beat the crap out of me with movement tricks. I remember at one point I was like, this game sort of, I get it. And then he was playing Khorne, and he pinned just on a tail edge with like one or two flesh hounds on my main unit. And I was like, great, now I pile in and kill. He's like, nah, you got to go to the one or two flesh hounds over here. I'm like, that's a thing you can do. Okay. And just completely ruined my turn. And then he just came in with Scarbrand and killed me. And I was like, okay, yeah. So, but again, as you're saying, a lot of those things are very, very specific tricks that from reading the books, you wouldn't obviously get it. And even if you read the written battle reports, you don't really see it unless you actually see it on table and you go, I get it. And that's where a lot of these more tricky things, you do get them when you play against good opponents as such.
And then you always learn, like, you won't be doing that again. Or you'll be like, I'll be looking out for those little pile-in tricks on the corners of units. And then you deploy them yourself against your opponent. And then they learn from it. And they go, okay, that's what you can do.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing on that in terms of learning is try not to put things down to luck or rolls. One of the main things that you learn is that the best players don't rely on luck because they don't put themselves in a situation where luck has to even come up in the first place. Consistently the same players are at top of the tournament every time, and it's not because they're just rolling the most sixes every single time. if your game is coming down to luck, that actually means you've played a very good and tight game. But in the majority of games, they don't come down to luck. They come more down to positioning, which is something that you can actively do. And if you start to move things as, it was just bad dice rolls is why I lost, then there's very little improvement you can do on that as to why you actually lost. And again, if you do think it was just bad dice rolls, having a genuine chat with your opponent being like, okay, bad dice rolls aside, what did I do wrong? I think you'd be surprised as they'll be like, oh, here's the seven things that
you didn't notice. Yeah. I find dice are very easy to blame because people don't like blaming themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
And I suppose that one main thing with the dice as well is it can even come down to your list design. You might have just designed your list badly before even the game started, so you're already on that back foot. It wasn't down to having bad luck. It was down to like the wrong list design that you come up against your opponent with.
Yeah, for sure. It's generally either bad list design or the other slightly more common one, I would say, is not implementing and understanding the list fully. You know, much more common when you get sort of net listing things where you like they have the key piece that they need to beat you, but they just don't use it, or it's just like sitting in the back corner doing something else. And you're like, all right, well, if you're insisting. But yeah, definitely understanding the list. So building a list properly that has good balance as well as, you know, high damage and high wounds, as well as being able to actually properly use the things in your list. Yeah, definitely helps.
From early in our conversation, you sound like you're one that enjoys a lot of list tinkering and list writing then.
For sure. I probably, as horrible as it sounds, I probably spend more time writing lists than I do playing Warhammer. Okay. you think about a GTV and like, you know, five games for 2 hours each sort of thing, 10 hours. I probably spend, you know, 25, 30 hours of list tinkering to get to the 10 hours of actual gameplay. Like, so by the time I hit the table, like I know my list so damn well because I've tinkered it that many times.
Do you do a lot of that in writing notes? Or you find you do a lot of that mentally in your head?
Just mentally as well as on Excel. So Excel is important just because sometimes you can write a list, but then when you actually go, wow, that'd be great damage. And then you actually punch the damage into a table and you go, it's kind of bad. Like it sounds good in theory. And then you just run the numbers and you go, like a great example of that is personally, I wasn't a big fan. I wanted to like it, but I didn't. But people at a time were running the Claw Lord for Skaven with the boat, and you can send them up the boat and you can go in and slap people like, oh, it's great. It's like, sure. But if you miss that one flaming weapon at the start and then you send them in, you hit for like 8 wounds and you're like, man, suiciding my 100-point hero plus the boat plus the frenzy plus the flaming weapon and building my entire list tech and going in and hitting for 8. It's just not enough. Not in the unfair state the game is in, where people hit you for like 40. Like if you're gonna do something, you gotta do it, you know. But so running the numbers can sometimes, often you see people build a whole list around a certain combo, and you go, you added 500 points of support to do a bonus 5 damage. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah.
What other aspects of the hobby do you enjoy? Do you enjoy? Obviously, you enjoy tournaments. Do you enjoy like building and painting models as well?
I'm not too big. I'm becoming better at enjoying that. I think for me, I originally found painting to be that annoying thing you had to do in order to actually play the game. But now that I'm past that point, I've actually got all the Skaven models and I've got the strong core. I want to build a new list. I only need to buy and paint one model. You know? Like it's like that one guy, and I can actually spend time on it. I think for me, painting is also hard because I'm someone who I travel a lot. I tend to move houses a lot. So I tend to not like owning a lot of stuff. And I think to do painting properly, as you have there, you've got
I've got a garage full of stuff.
You've got the whole garage full of stuff. It's like, I tend to like traveling very, very light. And I find the painting side just tends to go more towards having lots of desks and space and everything. Again, being based in Melbourne CBD and working from home, space is a premium.
That's fair.
I don't like my working desk is my Warhammer desk. I have a tray about this big that is my entire paint station. Wow. Carrying around with me.
And so here I have like a full-on like work desk is my painting station.
Yeah, that's it. So I'm getting better at the painting stuff, but I think for me the thing that I probably like the most about the tournament side is don't get me wrong, playing the tournament games is my fundamental first and foremost. But AOS has a very nice crowd. I just like having the chats between games, catching up. I'm not a huge drinker, but I do drink like one or two sort of thing. And it's just got a really nice community about it. So that's probably the main thing. I think when you go to when you're just playing at clubs do also have that social community, of course. But there's a certain special thing about tournament play. I don't know what it is, and just catching up with the same guys every time. How'd your game go? What were you doing? And I think, yeah, I really like that social aspect of the tournament side. So that's a big part for me. And I know a lot of people talk about, you know, I don't know if you're on the 40K side of things. I don't play 40K, but
I've not really followed that at all.
I don't play 40K, but a lot of people say that, you know, 40K players are a lot worse.
Yeah,
in terms
that's
of
what
their,
I've heard too. Yeah.
And like, that'd be a real shame to go to a tournament and just be like, oh, you know, yeah, I played some games, but you know, it was all right. And at the end of the day, if you're not enjoying this game, then what are we doing?
It's a lot of money here. Why are you playing a game that you don't enjoy and spend a lot of money on?
a lot of money and a lot of time to not actually focus on enjoying the game. So I think that's probably my main thing I like about the tournament side is it's very enjoyable. And on that note, when you get to a tournament and you're too in the zone, you lose and you're beating yourself up, it's like, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. Just enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Tournaments are great social places. Like you just get to catch up with your mates from like 2 or 3 months and gaps. And so you get to hear their story from maybe their last few tournaments and all this sort of stuff. And then you get the nights, if like they've got nights planned as well, you get to catch up and hang out there. You got all these different community aspects outside of just playing the competitive games.
Yeah, that's it. And it is really important to have that community aspect there. Within Australia, a lot of our tournaments are at pubs, which helps a ton. So you don't even have to go very far.
Yeah, it makes it real easy.
Yeah, for sure.
Were you saying before that you don't like having a lot of models and like painting and hobby stuff? Is that why you've lent into just playing Skaven?
Most likely, to be honest. I think in a world where if this was purely an online, like almost like a TTS format game, I probably would play more than Skaven. But the fact that you have to do the whole paint up and everything, plus I am very time poor in general, just in my life. So I just like I think about the idea of having to commit, you know, and I'm also terribly slow as a painter, like ridiculously slow. So the idea of having to commit another 50 hours to painting stuff, something up, and getting to that annoying point of like, oh, I want to play this army, but I have to do this chore before I got to do this chore before I get to actually do the thing I want to do. I just, nah. So it probably does lean into it. But again, I've always just loved Skaven. I think for me, if I were to play another army, I would just play another game. So like I would play another army for 40K. I am quite looking forward to Old World when that comes out, because I'm hoping I've got enough Skaven I can split them down the middle and play Skaven in both Old World and AOS. And it does help keep the thoughts easier, because you're only having to think about one army rather than multiple. But Skaven is a very lucky army to have one as your only army, because, you know, I feel for the people out there who have... And not to knock on anyone with these armies, but if you're running an army like a KO or something like that, where they do one thing, it's great fun, but they do one thing. And the nice thing with Skaven is that it's got so much variety depending on who you're playing. It's a counterplay army that you can tinker, you can tech. The book's really wide, so you can play one army and just never get bored of Skaven. I've still got things in Skaven that I've never actually played. And I'd love to just build a list focused on Eshin, or focused on Mulder, focused on Pestilence, go full Scryer, go full Horde Swarm with Clan Rats, all playing a very different style within the one book. So Skaven is very lucky in that sense to have that variety, and, you know, makes it so you don't get too bored too easy.
The joy of a collectionist army.
Yeah, for sure.
How have you gotten around some of these older sculpts and them being hard to find or out of stock, or they cost $20 per model and you need 5 per unit, like the Scry Acolytes?
Yeah, like the Scry Acolytes. So a few things here. One, which was hilarious for me, was, as I said, I took like a 12, 13 year gap between fantasy coming back and finding the game that I love no longer exists. And then when I came back into AOS, I was like, great, well, let's see, you know, surely my army is not legal anymore. Let's see, surely there's new sculpts and my army is like ancient. Like, I got the latest models. This is great. Like, literally nothing changed. I think I lost 2 poisoned wind mortars. And that was it. So for me, dealing with old sculpts was fine, because I have old sculpts.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that wasn't a problem for me. There definitely were some units like Plague Sensor Bearers and Acolytes. And I know this may be a bit, I'm assuming I can talk about in this channel, controversial, but there are some really good 3D prints out there for Skaven. So there are phenomenal 3D prints out there. Whether you're looking for ones that are on the more free side, or if you're looking to go, there's many Patreons out there that have some really sick thematic Skaven prints across the board. Now, they're often not Skaven prints. They're designed for other games, and they'll be called like the Ratmen of the Sewer and stuff like that. But you know, I've got one here. Actually, it's on a... Let me try to unblur my background. Give me 1 second.
All good.
This one's...
If you notice on my background, there's a lot of brightly colored plastics, because they're all 3D printers. I'm a massive 3D printer fan myself.
There you go. So I lost them off the base, but that's like a hell pit abomination.
Oh, that was your hell pit. I remember seeing that on at the Masters.
On the stream. Like, that's, you know, I think I bought that one from a patron that was like $10, which, you know, really nice, sick model. There's nothing wrong with the original model either. But yeah, especially when it, as you're saying, when it comes to like Acolytes and PCBs, don't spend $600 getting Acolytes. Just like, even if you want the original ones, like, come on, man, $600, like, there's better things for $600.
There's only one person that I know that does that, and that's Smorgon, with his bloody gutter runners and night runners and everything else.
And that's it. That's his thing. He can do that. And he's well into the game where he can get to that point. But if you're just starting, please don't buy $600 worth of gutter runners.
They don't look the best either. Sorry, Sam.
But I really like the old sculpts. And with that said, though, there are also a lot of, because it's such an old army, there's lots of ways that you can, there's lots of known ways to kit bash. So the best example is, if you want Plague Censer Bearers, just get Plague Monks and just put a little flail or add a little chain onto the end, and you got Plague Censer Bearers. If you want Gutter Runners, a lot of people like buying the Blood Bowl set for Skaven, which basically look like pretty cool Gutter Runners. So there are really nice kit bash things, but personally, I like the 3D printing side. I know a lot of people are against it, probably less so now these days, but there's something actually nice about playing against an army where, like, you know what the models are, but these are all brand new, like, new things that you've never seen before. I quite like that. I do understand where some people have a gripe with it, where people will use a print and it doesn't represent the thing, and then it's kind of like somewhat a tactical advantage because you're like, oh, that's a wizard, the guy with the sword, so I get that. But for me, I'm a big fan of the printing, especially for those niche units like PCBs, PCBs, Acolytes. But yeah, that's just my take. And I don't think there's anything wrong with paying for a Patreon, for people who have designed some really cool models, bring them to the table, and it's a new experience every time when you get to use those.
Especially nice when you come up against, say, like, the whole army's 3D printed, but it's very close to the actual sculpts, but they're slightly different in different ways or different aspects. But I found it's really hard when they've gone too far one way or the other, and you're not sure. There's five different units on the table, and you're not sure which one's which now, what they represent. That's when it's probably skewed too far to one way.
And again, I mean, the nice thing with how I've done this thing is, like, you put that thing on the table, no one's ever been like, was that the clan rat? Like, it's like, it's pretty definitive as to what the big guys are. So that does help a lot. And I mean, even on that note, like, I've got one of the, like, original Vermin Lords, and I've fully magnetized them so I can change them out. And it's a funny question I always get, is people being like, oh, do you have to magnetize it so you got the right weapon loadout? Unless I'm playing another Skaven player, they don't even know which Vermin
That's
Lord
right.
it is. It's like, big rat, that's your Vermin Lord. This dude, that's your Hellpit. These are your clan rats. The big cannon, that'll be the cannon.
I started doing the magnetizing part for my Vermin Lords, and then decided I'm just going to do a mix of both weapons, and I can just say it's either or, because there's
No one
probably no
cares.
chance I'm going to have that exact same model on the table, two of them, and no one's going to figure it out, because you paint them slightly different if you wanted to as well.
The only people who are going to know are other people who also play that army. And if they play that army, they're smart enough to be like, this one's this, this one's that. Okay. Like, so at which point you're fine. But yeah, so definitely into the printing side, especially for Skaven. The sculpts are so old, that there is a really nice set of 3D prints out there from a variety of different places, where, they're reasonably priced, they look really good, and you're not having to, battle with things being out of stock on the Games Workshop site for, 6 months, 12 months at a time, or paying $20 per model and you need 30 of them.
That's a bit ridiculous.
Sure.
With getting into the hobby and picking Skaven, if you didn't have the Skaven lying around already, would you have gone back to Skaven, or would you have gone to a different army?
Good question. I think, look, Skaven definitely would have been a consideration right up there, because I would have wanted something with a high level of versatility. That's one of my prerequisites, is something that has versatility, so that each game is unique and that there's a certain level of thinking involved in playing the game. That being said, I actually think I probably would have played Soulblight Gravelords. I really like, it's the one thing that Skaven is missing, is I really like control style gameplay. And I actually think Soulblight Gravelords are arguably the king of control gameplay in this game. So I actually think I probably would have went to Soulblight. But yeah, I had Skaven. I've already got him here. And they're like, oh, it's funny. I was talking to someone else, like, oh, why don't you just get a Soulblight arm? I'm like, oh, man, this is a painting.
Soulblight is a massive attempt. Like, because all the models, majority of them are new. So you've got a lot of extra detail and greeblies, like what GW does. Like, I've gone through and painted up. And then you need hordes. So hordes are another pain in the neck. Yeah.
I might go to a world where I just paint my clan rats with like zombie arms and be like, they're zombie clan rats. It's kind of like double. but short of that, it's just like I can't be bothered. But I've tried to make control Skaven work. And in the current book, it just doesn't. It's a bit disappointing. I've tried to make it work and it just doesn't hit the mark. And I think that's more due to I was having a chat with Joel McGrath about this actually not too long ago, and that's more due to the fact that the current GHB just really doesn't favor control lists in general. It's why you look across most armies, there's very, very few control lists, and even the ones that are control, like people will say Lumineth is control. It's like control, blast you off the table.
Control with a lot of damage.
There's not a lot of like Zench is control. I'm like, how is this control? It's doing like 40 mortals per turn, you know? But just control at the moment is kind of weak. And so we'll see how the new GHBs go for if that changes. And if it does, I've got like 140 clan rats ready to go.
Is it an aesthetic thing or a lore thing that you really enjoyed Skaven as an army to pick?
I think there was a lore thing again. So I really like the craziness of them. There's just back in fantasy, they had just the funniest lore. Like I always remember my favorite model of all time was Queek Headtaker. So Queek back in the day, the way it used to work was if your two heroes were next to each other, you could do a heroic challenge. So it's like, hey, you must fight me. And if you refused, you would lose leadership and your unit would have to go to the back of the pack. Skaven, being the cowards they are, could refuse a challenge and go to the back of the pack, and there was no bravery debuff because everyone's like, yeah, fair enough, I wouldn't want to die either. But Queek just had the funniest lore because he just thought he was the hottest shit, so he could not refuse a challenge. So like you go into like Archeon, he's just like, I'll challenge. Dies.
That's so good.
Or just the chaos that was like the chaos that used to be the Doom Wheels, the Doom Rockets, and just the, because Skaven has a very high risk, high reward style. And there's a very much an element of looking at the game and being like, is it the time to pull the high risk, high reward thing and trying to position the game where the risk is actually quite small and the reward is quite large because of how it's positioned. I really like that. I like the lore. I used to play Lord of the Rings before coming into fantasy. And I played dwarves back then. And there's probably an element of like dwarves and ratmen. They both live in tunnels. I think there was some part of my brain when I was like 14 or 15 that said I already had sand for my dwarf for the sand base, and like I don't have to buy a new like basing because I've already got a bucket of sand ready to go. So I'll do something that you. I'm sure there was something in there about like I've already got sand. So
the classic money saving. Yep.
Well, hey, when I was 14, like you know, a box of clan rats was like a month, 2 months worth of savings. It was insane. That's fair. You know, if I could save $20 on sand, I'll do so. So probably an element of that. I really do like the lore. I like the variability. I like their aggressive, like high magic, high damage, but very glass cannony while still being a horde trying to block the board. Because I think the thing about that is when you play a high damage army, you control the game. To a certain degree, like you, it's up to you to win the game or you to lose the game based upon your mobility and damage. Where I often feel for some opponents where if they're running a slower army and it just feels like they're sitting there while I'm just moving around cutting pieces and they move for their turn and that's all they can do, you know. At least with Skaven, I always feel like there's something I can do that's going to swing the game. So yeah, I really like that about them.
That's fair enough. Do you enjoy like that high risk, high reward dice rolling, like the casino dice of will I roll the sixes? Because as generally most control players sort of like to be more on the lower end of like, oh, I'm rolling twos and twos or twos and threes. Do you enjoy that high risking dice rolls?
Yes and no, funnily enough. So like it's a really funny thing about that. So one of the things with Skaven that I gravitate to is the triple master clan. Like pretty much every list I've ever run has been triple master clan. I remember when it first came out, everyone thought it was the bee's knees. Then it got nerfed and everyone thought it was suddenly crap. It's not crap. It just got like, it went from amazing to really nice. But everyone sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater on that one. I think for me, it is high risk, high reward. But as I was saying before, it's all about trying to actually reduce the risk and increase the reward as much as you can. Just shutting the door. Probably like, I'm watching my stuff out here. So it's all about trying to change the risk reward ratio effectively. So it's about looking at the table and being like, okay, if I pull this now, this is the potential outcome, but how can I change the game state so that way you are changing the risk reward ratio? I think, because again, if it's something that's like hitting on sixes, I actually don't like gutter runners and I don't like things like that, which are like mortals on sixes, because I actually think they're too risky. Whereas the reason why I like Triple Master Clan is it means I can deep strike 9 inches out and have a 75% chance of landing it in. Still means there's a 25% chance I won't, but I will hit it more often than I don't. I like the high risk, high reward ratio stuff, but then I also like trying to put the game into a state where it's less risky. I don't like if it's a thing that's just like, look, it's a coin flip. If I hit heads, I win. If I hit tails, you lose. Then you're only ever going to win 50% of the time, and that's pretty bad. I'm trying to think about what's the most high risk. So it's high risk in that with Skaven, if you screw up, you get punished for it very hard. But it's high reward in that if I play perfectly, it just feels like there's not a whole lot you can do. And the best example of that was things like clan rats, right? If I can position my clan rat screens perfectly and I give it the turn to the opponent, they go, I'm going to hit 100 clan rats for this turn but that's all there is. But if I misposition that like little bit and something gets in and just chomps my back line, the game's done. Like that's my form of high risk, high reward. It's not necessarily like rolling a six on the dice, high risk, high reward. It's if perfect play is had, you have a perfect game and you do very well, but slight mistakes will chomp at you very, very hard. So you need to really think about those mistakes and make sure everything's really tight. Otherwise, there's a huge risk that you just lose the game.
Are you then a fan or not a fan of warp lightning cannons?
In the correct meta, I am a fan. However, I'm not a fan of one warp lightning cannon. I am a fan of three or more warp lightning cannons.
It's the Skaven way.
well, because the problem with one is random and risky. Three, like if I have one, I could do 2 wounds, I could do 12 wounds, I could just kill my own cannon. If I have three, and I know that when I overcharge and they do an average of 7 damage, I know in my head that I can do approximately 21 damage on average with three cannons. Now it may be closer to like maybe closer to like 30, 40, it may be closer to like five. But I know that on average I have about a 21. So I actually really like three cannons because you have that they balance each other out. So you've still got the high risk, high reward ratio they have to think about, but on average you're hitting for 21. Where when you got one, again, that's where I'm rolling for one is me rolling for sixes. Three is me rolling for standard deviation in the
Yeah,
middle.
okay, yep. That makes perfect sense.
So big fan of three cannons, not a fan of one cannon.
Removing that variability down to a more manageable state.
Yeah, for sure. I do like the cannons in the right meta. I don't think right now is the meta, but I think that meta might be turning the corner, especially with Soulblight Gravelords here kicking people in the butt. Nothing takes down a Soulblight Gravelord, Vampire Lord, and Zombie Dragon quite like three cannons. It's nearly guaranteed to kill it if it comes within 24 inches of your side of the cannons. And Soulblight Gravelords really can't get at the cannons. They don't have an ability to sort of deep strike in and take it out. Plus, it's pretty good into OBR as well. So into those types of armies, but into other types of armies, it's not so good. So it really it's a meta pick, but outside of like the Vermin Lord Warbringer and 60 clan rats, everything in Skaven is a meta
Yeah, that's
pick.
fair. Is that your main staple? Is it the Warbringer?
I would say the Warbringer is my main staple. Thankful has become a main staple as well. The Warbringer is just, I literally don't know of a single matchup other than Nighthaunt where I wouldn't want the Warbringer. You can fail all of its spells and it just hits like a truck. It can scurry away. It's got good movement. Dreaded Death Frenzy is probably one of the best spells in the game, in my opinion, especially when leveraged correctly. And it just does work in every single list. Thankful is more or less a staple in that. I think with Thankful, there are some matchups where he's just god awful. And then there's other matchups where he's all right. The main matchup he's got awful is Gargants. How often? I don't know the last time I played Gargants. Like, and even when you do play them, I've got 1600 points of other crap that will deal with Gargants that Thankful's allowed to kind of, you know, just cast a spell and stand in the way. So for me, Thankful has become a mainstay in this current meta, but we'll see how the meta changes as to if that changes. But at the moment, Thankful, Warbringer, and 60 Clan Rats, and then everything else is then the meta pick of what I'm looking to sort of counter as such.
And I'm guessing he's been magnetized as well for his... Yeah. Flamethrowers,
yep.
Or is this the...
Yep. Yeah, four flamethrowers are four fists, so he's magnetized, and I painted all those up as well. He's, for anyone looking to get into it, the Vermin Lord is a bit trickier to magnetize. Thankful is surprisingly easy to magnetize, but all of his arms are like super thick. You can just fill them with goo and then just put a magnet in. It's very, very easy to magnetize. But the Vermin Lord is a bit tricky because you got different heads, different weapons, different legs, different feet, friggin' the whole lot. So he's a lot harder.
I find with the Vermin Lord, you've got to pick two builds you sort of want to play them through, because the big glaive is a big point, or you're standing on the stone. You sort of really got to leverage which way you want to go with it.
For sure, for sure.
And with you saying you like your control lists and stuff like that, what is your sort of play style then? Are you quite an aggressive player? You find you quite reactionary? Where do you think you lean on the play style?
I would say I'm more reactionary. I've described to people in the past, the way that I play Skaven is I'll lay out five or six different traps across the map, and whichever one that you forget about is probably the one that I'll go after. So I'm not going to play the same game every time. I'm going to sort of set up the vulnerabilities and see if you... Again, that's the whole thing with Skaven, is like you can put your gnaw holes a certain distance away, and that, so that way if you don't go to the gnaw holes and you're bubbled up, I'm going to hit you with Warp Lightning Vortex and like my endless spells and try to pin you in. If you do go to the gnaw holes, you're suddenly broken up, so now a Doom Wheel is going to land in the middle of your ranks because you can't hold all the spots, or the Vermin Lord's going to teleport in. So I would say I'm a very defensive reactionary player. One of my sort of golden rules for playing this game, and if anyone's on the newer side, my number one tip is learn to play a fantastic turn one plus deployment, because I can guarantee you don't know how you're going to go the rest of the game, but you will have a turn one. And at some point they're going to make you go first.
I think that's the main reason is you'll be going first the whole time pretty much.
Yeah, especially if you're running like this classic 10 drop Skaven list, you're in 9 times out of 10 you're going first. And so literally I have a plan in mind of like, here is how my turn one is going to go. And you need to have something that's going to be that turn one play. Move up into the middle and do nothing is not a good turn one play. You can do that if like you're actually a one drop and you just happen to lose the priority and sure you needed to get some objectives. But like, if you are serious about, you know, being a 10 drop army, you know, they're going to force you turn one. Have a proper deployment, have a proper plan in mind for turn one, and not just what you're going to do on your turn one, but then what they're going to do on their subsequent turn one. So if I'm moving to here, then they're going to do X, Y, Z. So you need to know, okay, again, this is where it comes down to, I don't need to know a lot about Varangard, but I need to know they move 10 and they can run and charge. So that's 16 inches, plus if they charge 9, maybe make it 10, I need to be X distance away. That's all you need to know. Everything else about that stat right now, I don't care. I just need to know I need to be that distance away. So that's probably the main thing for me. I'm a very reactionary player. I will generally be forced to take first. I will then move into a position where I'll force the opponent to have to make a bad choice or mistake to some degree. And when they do, you will then exploit whatever the largest mistake that they made. And the thing with Skaven is there's a hell of a lot of mistakes to make. You need to block, as I said, you got to block out the Skittleleaps. You got to block out the wheels. You got to block out Thankful and Launcheon. You got to block out the endless spells. You know, you gotta, and even with all of that, you gotta remember I've still got Scurry Away. You need to somehow get past my chaff lines. Even if you get past the chaff lines, the things behind it are loaded with Dreaded Death Frenzies up. So there's a lot of, traps and mechanisms along the way that just I keep in mind, and I'll work out depending on the opponent what's going to be the most suitable one to use.
And that's where knowing your own army comes in quite
for
effectively.
Sure. For sure. Yeah, you need to know your own army very, very well, and where, like, what's too far away, what's too close, you know, and where you need to position everything, to get that perfect sweet spot of everything is working. You're slightly too far, you get pulled apart. You're slightly too close together, you're not maximizing your space and actually doing what you need to do. So, yeah, very, very defensive, reactionary player, which is, again, leans me to more towards actually having a control style list. But right now, control means bubble up, you can't hit me, but I'm going to blast you with mortals. That is control right now, for whether we like it or not. And so that sort of is where I'm at currently.
Okay. And how has that taken you over the competitive season?
Pretty. I mean, so far, I keep freaking missing out my 5-0. And KO is my mortal enemy right now. I think of my last 8 or 9 GTs, I've pretty much gone 4-1 at all of them except for one, which was, again, stopped by Soulblight on the final step. I keep losing to KO, but that's, again, because KO is very, very strong against Skaven. But even then, I feel like I put up a good fight, but just don't quite get there at the end of the day.
Need to be a little bit lucky on those dice.
Yeah, I mean, for some of them, it is a case of that. The last one I had at SAGT was just monumentally my fuck up. I can't blame anything other than that. It was the first game. I set up everything. I literally said to I was playing against Kron, who's a good mate of mine, and I said to him before the game. So the last time he beat me, he killed Thankful turn one, and I'm like, I said to him, I'm not letting you kill Thankful turn one. It's not happening. Like, I'm putting him right at the back. Anyway, so he set up his deployment. I set up my deployment. And he's like, are you done? I said, yes. And he's like, interesting bait. You left Thankful right at the front of your deployment lines. And I was like, yeah, bait. That's what it was. I was sitting there thinking, why did I put him at the goddamn front? And then turn one, he just got blasted off the table. I was like, god damn it.
You'll get there one day.
Yeah, we'll get there one day. But I think that is... And I was talking with Wayne about this as well. I think one of the hardest things about Skaven, and sadly, this is exactly what I was talking about before, is the part I love about Skaven, is they are high risk, high reward. The problem is, over 5 games against good opponents, you're going to make one mistake somewhere. Like you're not perfect. And the problem with Skaven is that one mistake is enough for them. Yeah, they're blasting through your chaff lines, they're blowing you up, and you can lose the game on one mistake. You know, he was saying at that particular tournament, he was taking Nurgle, and he was like, it's so refreshing for me to just, like, make a mistake and be like, I took some wounds. It didn't matter.
Yep.
I'm Nurgle. I've got health. Like, it didn't matter. Where, again, I make one deployment mistake the whole tournament, 4-1, you're out the game.
Yeah, which is always rough, because it means you've got to be on your game the whole tournament, and that one little lapse can cost you it all. They haven't got the forgiveness there like a lot of the top meta armies do. That's what makes them, I think, so strong, as well as there's a lot of points where if you screw something up, it doesn't matter as much. Whereas these mid sort of tier armies can go and play in the top game, but once you make that small mistake, that's when they're back down to mid tier again.
I think they have that, plus they also have consistency, in the sense that, like, they do the same thing every time, and they always do it. Teclis Castle is always going to shoot you with Sentinels, and it's always going to get Total Eclipse and whatever else it is, and it's going to do its thing. KO is always going to come out at you 9 inches away and will shoot something. You can't not have KO shoot you. You know, the old Seraphon Thunder Lizards back in the day with the, you know, stupid turtle things launching solar engines at you. Like, it's going to hit you, and you're not going to be able to deal any damage back. Like, it was, and Croak's always going to be able to hit you with his spell, and you're not, and he's going to try and unbind you. Like, there was a consistency in each of them. They did the same thing every time. And because they do the same thing every time, it's easier to not make mistakes because you're doing the same thing every time. Whereas if you're playing an army that has to challenge an opponent in terms of, like, being responsive, you have to do a different thing every time, which leaves you a lot more vulnerable to making a mistake. And then you just make one mistake and you can unravel on that, sadly.
Well, we used to hear all the time, oh, I took the 9 Storm Fiends and went 4-1 or 5-0. And then you sort of ask them, oh, did you come up against any magic armies? They're like, no. Well, then, like, it sort of was like, well, That's why, because no one unbound your one vital spell.
The one thing, the one spell that you have no casting bonus on, that your entire list is pinned on, or like no one was able to snipe the engineer down and suddenly you've done no damage. But yeah, if you just get lucky on your matchups, sure, 9 Storm Fiends is probably one of the best lists in the game if you just happen to play into things that can't take out an engineer.
Or you can roll a 7 at least.
Yeah, that's it. Just roll your dice. Or if you can't roll 7, you can retreat back in the corner, wait one turn, and then go in again. It's worth noting I have no Storm Fiends. It's one of the few units I don't have. If there is one thing I would say about armies, I tend to not like ranged damage. I think that's personally just because I find, with the exception of the Warp Lightning Cannons, I like that aggressive melee movement style of gameplay. It feels like a much funner game for me. Nothing against other people who want to play ranged armies. You do you. But I really enjoy melee armies. It feels more like I'm playing the game as a commander and moving stuff around. And I'm ultimately here to enjoy this game. So for that reason, I actually don't have a lot of ranged output in any of my lists.
I suppose that's why you sort of enjoy Soulblight, or want to look at Soulblight at some point. I suppose.
And it just feels like you're playing Left 4 Dead for a while and just bringing shit up.
And I suppose last season you done quite well with the Skaven allowing you to go to Masters then.
Yeah, I mean, that was lucky. In fact, I wasn't even meant to be at Masters because I think a few people dropped out or couldn't get tickets and stuff like that. So I got offered the last minute lucky dip ticket number.
You made the most of it at least.
Yeah, so I was glad I did manage to do all right at Masters in that sense. But I was getting some consistent 4-1s last season, which was nice. Wasn't able to ever get the 5-0, but again, like each opponent that beat me, it wasn't ever like I lost to an opponent. I was like, damn, I should have beat that guy. Like, he didn't know what he was doing. Like, each of these opponents are like, yeah, they fucking beat me. Like, these are good opponents that are very good at the game, and like I deserve the placements that they're at. And so with that in mind, it was and I only got into the game a year ago, so I was very happy to make Masters as I did, just as the final cutoff. Hopefully I can make Masters again this year. I'm currently on the 2-4-1s already, so...
You're well on your way then.
Well, I need to get a 5-0 somewhere in there.
That's fair.
Somewhere along the line, but we'll see. We'll see how we go for the rest of the year.
Yeah. I know a lot of people heard all about the Princess Tale story of you going to Masters with your Skaven and playing in the finals. Do you mind just giving me a little recap of how your run went over the whole weekend?
Yeah. So game one was Joel Graham and his Gits. So pretty tough matchup. That being said, because the nature of Masters, it was the one I had the most preparation and knowledge into, because I knew I was playing him and I knew I was playing his Gits. So therefore I had an ability to sort of not list Taylor, but like, as I was saying before, like I literally had in my mind, if I get the priority, this is my turn one, my turn two, this is what I'm looking to do. If he gets the priority, this is what I'm looking to do. And like thinking if he puts his Loon Shrine here, here, or here, this is what I'm looking to do. So it was a high level of, tailoring there. Effectively what happened there, map one was Jaws against Gits. The main thing to keep in mind with Jaws is it's really important to win turn two prior. Because that if you win turn two prior, you can take the turn and blow up their back objective, which forces them into you rather than you being forced into them. That's a big, big thing. So I took the first turn, even though I did basically zero damage with zero output. And I knew that he's going to come at me and blow me up. So I literally went, I had the clan rats literally lined on the very edges of the map, just touching the two objectives. I skittle leaped a clan rat into the middle one for a cunning maneuver, I believe it was. Drop my spells. I set up a boat ready to bring him back on the following turn. That boat did get dispelled, so that Gracie just got horribly, horribly murdered. But then the nice thing was, even though he had the turn, there's really nothing within a suitable range that he's not going to be able to run and charge. He's not going to be able to do anything that's particularly scary there. The main thing that sort of, so then because I managed to take first, I actually won turn two prior, which was fantastic, blew up his back objectives. That forces him forwards away from his shrine. So he can choose to stay near his shrine if he wants, but that means he's not on the objectives anymore. Bring him forwards. He did a decent amount of damage on coming forwards. Then I've managed to sort of counter my turn too. Probably the big turning point was two into three. So He left a vulnerability in the back, so I skitter leaped a Vermin Lord over to his back, trying to do the Master Clan charge, and I missed. I'm like, God damn it. So he's my Vermin Lord sitting there. I'm like, that's not where you want to be. The big turning point of the game was turn three. And again, there's a lot. So one thing worth noting here is at Masters, the ruling was, because it's a high-level tournament, you need to remember the rules. And if you miss an activation, you forget to use a spell, anything like that, you're not allowed to go back. And the assumption is that there's no, like I said, everything's on table as such. Probably the biggest turning point of that game was Joel then loaded up his Bounders, I believe it was. Yeah, he had the fight on death, the mortals, the bonuses to hit. He ran him into the Vermin Lord. The Vermin Lord's he's gone. He then also sent Grincrack's Loon Court into some Plague Sensor Bearers. And in my opinion, this was he played a great game, mind you. There's a reason why he's a very strong player. This was the one mistake he made all game, and sadly it cost him heavily. He then activated on Grincrack's Loon Court first, thinking that the Vermin Lord's gonna fight into the things with Death Frenzy and like it'll be a wipeout and he'll take that fight. Completely forgot that Scurry Away exists. So he did zero damage with Grincrack's Loon Court, and then I just did a Scurry Away. Not only did I scurry away, so now my Vermin Lord's still alive. I moved onto an objective that he wanted to take, combined with he didn't get his battle tactics, so his turn three was a one-point turn. And then I had my turn coming up next, and because my Vermin Lord was in the back, I managed to move him up, charge at the guys that were guarding the shrine, smash the shrine, kills the guys guarding the shrine, and then Thankful blasted one of the set of squigs off the table. So then suddenly he was just left with, two sets of squigs with no revival. And that would be fine if he had have gotten a 5-point turn three, but he got a 1-point turn three. So he was behind on points, he was behind on table, and he's lost his revival mechanism. And from there, it's pretty hard for Gitz to win. I believe at that point, we didn't even get to the next turn. I believe it was a concede at that point. So that was game one. Again, very strong play. In my opinion, he made one mistake. And it was a very, very tight, very tough game with a lot of both Skaven and Gitz have a lot of minor activations going on, a lot of things to remember. And sadly, that was just the one thing that he forgot.
And losing your Loon Shrine really hurts as well.
Yeah. And also the other thing was on his turn two, I believe, he forgot to do the revive at his Loon Shrine. So he has the two dice to revive. But again, this is Masters. We had moved past that phase. And so the revival was missed. So a combination of things there just really, again, while he's a good player, I'll put that down to a certain degree of he plays a lot of armies. He plays 6, 7, 8 different armies. I think if he was a Gitz main and he played nothing but Gitz, I don't think he would have forgotten that. And things like that, where it just by playing one army does help reinforce some of these things. Game two was against Michael Clark, lovely guy, and I was very glad to. I did get my revenge. I literally had, when I got to the table, I was like, I let him know that the worst beating I've ever taken was by him. I'm like, that's it. We're getting revenge. He was playing the Cruel Boys. So basically, basic summary was, I believe he took the first turn, didn't quite do enough, moved up to the objectives, didn't quite do enough damage. So then I took my turn. I did take a bit of an aggressive move with Thankful. So I boated him right up to his 20 Gut Rippers that was really guarding the front of his castle. Thankful, I believe, burnt like 18 or 19 of them into the ground with one flamethrower. As he does, I think he got like a 1 on the redeploy. something very tragic. And the reason why I did that is because one, the main thing Thankful needs to kill is those 20 Gut Rippers at the front. But then two, I did happen to win the double. And the problem was that now with those Gut Rippers gone, it wasn't about losing the chaff at the front, but now I had space to put stuff in. So then suddenly I dropped a Warp Lightning Vortex and a Vermintide right on his Bolt Boys. And so they take mortals. They take mortals if they stay. They take mortals if they try to move. And they don't have a lot of health. So then by the time it got to his turn two, I believe he had like one Bolt Boy left. And he did a great job of trying to claw it back. He had some fanatics that nearly started going to town. So I've never fought fanatics before, and Jesus, they do some damage.
Oh yes, little tech of his.
Yeah, they do a lot of damage, and they fight first as well. So he had like two or three combats in a row of fighting first. I was like, man, am I gonna lose to like five fanatics? But then at the end of the day, Cruel Boy's just like, again, with the Warp Lightning and the Vermintide right on his castle. Cruel Boy's doesn't have the movement to move away. They really want to stay in one castle and deal out mortal wounds, and he just couldn't stay there. He was just chipping stuff down, and then by about three, he just ran out of steam in terms of damage output. That game three was against Terrence and his Varangard. That was possibly one of my favorite games of all time. He was a lovely opponent. And that I went into that thinking 15 Varangard, they're gonna charge me. I'm gonna hit him. One of us is gonna die real quick. And I remember saying, like, I feel bad for the streamers because this is gonna be a boring ass stream. Like, this is gonna be, oh, okay. Turned out to be a 5-turn slug match of a game. And to the nature of it, despite the fact that he's got 15 Varangard with what 16 inch movement with the run and charge. We ended the game with him still having like nine Varangard left. I still had Thankwall and Vermin Lord and some Clan Rats and stuff. So it was a very movement heavy game. Because basically the issue was that if I went into the mid board, he's going to kill me. But if he tries to come into me and fails, I'll kill him. So we ended up just dancing around for a very long time. The main thing that hurt him, one, the map choice was not great for him, mainly because this was ours for the taking, the one that's really long. Two things. One, he only had one GC, which was his only wizard, which I killed very early. So once that was gone, he couldn't get the bonus points for having a GC on the middle. He also couldn't dispel any endless spells. That meant that Warp Lightning Vortex couldn't be dispelled by him, and that stops his ability to run and subsequently run and charge. But probably more importantly, he couldn't get rid of Thankful's boat, which means that Thankful's moving 18 inches each turn, not just in my turn, but also in his turn. So Thankful's just jumping wherever he needs to go.
Yep.
And it ended up being, yeah, pretty strong slug match. He ended up, I think it ended up being like a four of like a 3 point difference, like 3-4 point difference. I probably could have had a few more points, but I got to the final turn. I knew that if I ended the turn where I was right then, I had won the game. And I was like, look, I could probably get more points, but I equally could do something stupid and lose the game.
And I think
Like, I'm
those
moving.
main things are like getting caught out by redeploy or something like that you didn't
Yeah,
expect. Yeah.
redeploys on and I lose my grand straddle. Something like that. I was like, I literally said to the guy, look, I'm just gonna take the safe road. I'm gonna end the game right now. I'll cash my chips in and we'll call it a day. But very, very good game. Very great player. Yeah, very, very movement heavy. There was probably only a few mistakes that he made. And like we talked about it afterwards, one was I think it was his turn one. Again, I did the strategy of skittle leap of grace here, warp lightning vortex on his army, bring up a boat so that way on his turn, if he can't dispel the boat, and I can do a what's it called cunning maneuver in the middle, if he can't dispel the boat and he'll have to use his unbind to do that, meaning he can't cast a spell because he's only got one wizard, that means that if it doesn't get unbound, I get to bring that grace here back. He chose the tactic of have three units charge an enemy, and I let him I let him know twice, just letting you know, endless spells move in both turns. And he was like, got it. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to break your heart here, but I'm about to. And then when it got to the end of the movement phase, I moved it back, and he's like, ah, yes.
I see you tried, but I did not adhere to it.
So there was that. Plus, yeah, losing his wizard early definitely hurt him. I believe he actually lost his wizard on a Cabalist 3d6 roll with double
Oh
ones, and
no.
then he did two, and he did five or six mortals to himself and killed
Oh.
himself. So he ended up killing
That
himself
always
on a
hurts.
miscast. And we've only got one hero, and that hero is the wizard. I understand why he did the Cabalist cast. It was the right play, but with that wizard down, it just became I have heroes and you don't. I can score bonus points in the middle and you can't. And when we're talking about a point slugfest, that extra one per turn in the middle that I can capture, or the fact that you can't unbind spells, ends up being the difference in the game. So that was that one. And then the grand final was against Dave Kerr, lovely guy again. I did get taken to Pound Town in the grand finals. That being said, it was a closer game than it may appear.
Yes, yeah.
Because the thing, again, when you're going into a thing like a Teclis Castle, like, if I sit there for five turns, I'm losing. Like, that's the reality of it. So what I had to do was I had to do the deep strike. I had to do get my charges off. So I brought out the PCBs. And that being said, with the Master Clan ability, there's a 50% chance I hit the Master Clan charge, which means that the drill gets in and the PCBs get in. Now, to go against one of the best players in Australia, when my brain is fried like a potato from the game before and I have no brain power, and to just, if someone comes up to you and says, you're playing the best guy in Australia, would you like a 50% chance of winning this game? I'd say, yes, I'm going to take that odds. Sadly, those odds didn't quite work. So I brought everything out of deep strike and then just kind of sat there. Then I got the subsequent, managed to get the double, moved in even further, and just flopped the charges. Like, even with them, I think my Vermin Lord was 7 inches out with the two Master Clan charges, plus Thankful giving him two more charges. I still couldn't get him in. And then losing that double. And then basically from there, he just, shot me off the board, and that was game. But I think I remember hearing something from him, and I was like, it's a very good summary of the game, which is that he put me in a position where I had to take all the risk. And because of that, I took the risk, and the risk didn't pay off. And that was exactly his plan. And that's why he won. And it's probably the most accurate summary of that game. Because the thing, even if I did hit the Master Clan charge turn one, it wasn't a one game. Like, there is the reason why he's won that game that many. He's won the tournament that many times. So, it was just a case of, you know, when your chips are down, you have to take the risk. And if you look at the odds and you go, look, 30% is the best chance you got at winning this game, then yeah, it's not great, but you take those odds, and, you know, 70% of the time you don't win. And that's probably the summary of the final game. There was also, again, in hindsight, there was a lot of mistakes I made on deployment. But I contribute a lot of that to the fact that my brain was absolutely fried after a monster game three with Terrence. And that just, I just didn't have the brain power to properly think about my deployments. And it wasn't until after I deployed, I was like,
it's always the way. Like,
because he had the auto unbind on the boat. And then once the boat was gone, I'm like, great, Thankful's walking. Like, he's not even near a Norhull. It's just like walking him up the board. I'm like, this sucks. But so that's probably the main summary of Masters. And it was great fun. I was very glad to be there. Look, while I did happen to end up, you know, in the grand final, any of the players I played in the first three rounds could have been there. Terrence, when he got the bronze, I was so happy, because I was like, man, after that game, I was like, you deserve to be in the final. Like, that was a hell of a game. I had such a headache after that game. even Joel, like, yes, he lost the game one realistically because of one mistake. If he didn't make that mistake, I really do believe that the game was his. And then Michael Clark, again, if he had, like, I did beat him quite handedly in that game, but tell you what, me getting the double 1-2 played a big factor in that. Yeah. If he had have got the prior back the other way, I would have lost probably Thankful or a Vermin Lord. Yes, I would have cleared out his stuff and I still would have been able to do some damage, but like, I would have been in a much worse position as a result. He just as easily could have been in the finals. I like to think if Clarkie had a one, he probably would have lost to the Varangards because they got the mortal wound stoppers. So I like to think that I helped them there. But
that's fair enough. Well, congratulations on your second place, though. You could be very proud of yourself for being in the hobby so early on and taking Skaven all the way to second place.
Yeah, no, it was good. And a lot of thanks to Wayne in particular. Cron as well. Cron helped, but Wayne was an absolute savior for me at Masters, being the other Skaven player. He was meant to be like the Skaven player for Masters, and I'm like, hey, I'm here too. Guess what? I was like, I'm coming too. He's like, all right.
Yep. That's so good.
And he helped me a lot. So like, he, again, like, for a lot of these matchups, because I'm still newer, he gave me, like, between each round, he had his own matchup to go and play, but he was much more focused on, like, this is the one you're going up against, this is what you need to do, this is the focus, this is the list. I would have been absolutely stomped without that info. So big thanks to him as well.
Yeah, well, shout out to Wayne then. Give you a hand for sure. Well, thanks for giving us your recap. I also put out a post on Twitter asking for a few questions here. So if you don't mind, I've got a few questions I want to ask you, or people wanted to ask you. Some of them you already answered, being Pat Nevin was asking you if you ever go 5-0 with Skaven.
Well, look, put it this way. There's only one person in Australia who's gone 5-0 with Skaven, and it's Pat, because because he brought 500 points of Skaven in his Nurgle list to Lynbrook, and he won with it. So he's done the best with Skaven in Australia. So I put my hands together to the Skaven master, Pat, who has taken them further than I have.
And another pressing question, Nathan Thompson wants to know, what is it you love so much about KO?
What? Oh, man, Nathan. I do need to get a rematch against Nathan in his KO. I also want to fight his Fire Slayers as well. I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't get to match against each other at SAGT, I won't lie. What is that I love about KO? The funny thing is, despite my terrible win record against KO, I think I'm now in competitive. So in tournaments, I think I'm now like 5 or 6 losses, 1 win against KO.
Wow.
Two now.
Oh, so nice.
It's still very much in the negatives. The funny thing is, despite my passionate hatred for KO and the fact that I keep losing to the damn army, I actually very much enjoy the match. I actually do think it is a very enjoyable match regardless. It's very different. I actually think Skaven has good potential into it. The issue is that, as we were saying before, I think a lot of the way that Skaven has to win that matchup, I have to hit the charge. Like, there's no other way about it. Well, now with the Doom Wheels, like, I've got other things that can do some work. And I've bought those Doom Wheels specifically for KO because screw them. Previously, with most of my Skaven lists, it was like, as much as I wanted it to be about positional play and this and that and this and that, there was that one critical moment where you had to hit the charge. And if you missed the charge, you lost. And I think that was probably the only part about it that I disliked, that there was like, that was a truly an element of, it does come down to a dice roll at one point in the game. Like, everything else helps with that dice roll, but it fundamentally, and the thing with KO is, if you miss that dice roll, you only get one turn to charge them. And if you miss it, you're dead. So I think that was probably the main thing, but I do actually enjoy the KO matchup. Every KO player I've played so far has actually been a very lovely person to play, and they've been very, very fun and very enjoyable. So, I will turn those stats around. I'm just going to build spite KO lists for the next year. I'll lose to everything else, and I'll just grind that KO stat all the way back up. But all right, they're nerfs coming. They're nerfs coming. Don't worry. I haven't seen anything, but I feel it. I'm certain that those Thunderers are getting nerfed. I know it.
It'll be the points going up, and then something else that people have overlooked will be just as strong.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's the thing with KO. Like, as soon as one thing gets nerfed, you know what? The thing that people don't talk about is the melee KO is actually surprisingly good. The mortals on the charge from everything, the healing on the boats. Fighting first. Most of the best KO lists I've played actually aren't that stacked into the Thunderers. They maybe have 10 or 15, which is what, 300, 400 points worth? That still means there's 1,600 points worth of crap that's really good kicking your butt.
Yeah.
And you could almost argue that 1,600 points is so good, you could take out those 400 points of Thunderers. It's still good. I hate Thunderers, but man, I hate 2 Ironclads just as much. So, you know, they'll nerf the Thunderers, but they'll still be a spooky list for sure.
Yeah, that's fair enough. We've got a lovely question here from Joel McGrath. How do you feel about submarining to second and knocking off the podium again?
Yes. Yes, I did. SAGT was a little bit of a submarine because I lost my first game by 1 point and then managed to submarine to second place. In my defense, though, on that, at the GT just before it, which was Border War, I was on the 4-0 table against the other 4-0 player in the top match. I lost, and then I got knocked down to like 8th place.
It feels so shit when that happens.
I have in 2 tournaments in a row been on opposite sides of the submarine where I was like, what do you mean I came 8th? I was like on the top table like at the end, and I didn't even lose by that much. I lost by like 6 points. And then suddenly I was like way down here. I'm like, that makes no sense. So I've equally been on both sides of the submarine. One thing I will say is, when it comes to most of the tournaments out in Bendigo, they do have anti-submarining rules. And I actually do appreciate those anti-submarining rules, for the reason being that it means that if you lose the first game, you can still podium, but you need to like win every game definitively from there. And it gives those people who actually are on the 4-0 and the final thing a good chance of podiuming because they've had the four wins in a row. So I really do like the anti-submarining rules they have out there. And I've now equally been on all sides of the submarine. I've been in the submarine, I've been the torpedo, and I've been the target.
So. Well, Joel's been the submarine quite a few times anyway, so I'm sure he's used to knocking other people off the podium.
Yeah, I mean, what do you complain about, Joel? I believe the first time we played, I beat him in the first round. He ended up coming third place. So, you know, it's... you know, I don't know if... it's, you know, kettle... What's it? Kettle calling the pot black? I don't know.
That's right. Joel's pretty much always known as the bridesmaid anyway. I don't think he's got the first place yet. He just keeps getting pipped off or put down to third or fourth. He's used to it by now.
You know what's funny? I've never come first place yet. Even in local one dayers, I've still never come first place. So I feel his pain. The best I've done now is second place.
From a submarine.
Three times. So I've... I think there was one day where I got second place because I won all three of my games, but someone else also won three games and they won them by more. And I was like, what the hell is this? So
yeah, that's so good. Jason does want to know what your favorite cheese is.
Favorite cheese. I'm probably without sounding truffle. I'm without sounding fancy. I'm a truffle brie man. I do like a good truffle brie.
Oh, very nice.
It's a very classic cheese. I don't like the very fancy truffle brie. A really cheap and nasty truffle brie. I don't know how to describe it other than that. It's something like a Coles caramel mud cake. It's like it's trying to be fancy but in the cheapest way possible. And there's something about that that's just very nice. So truffle brie is definitely the way to go.
Do you like it by yourself or do you have it with a cracker? What's your
with a cracker? Yeah, for sure. Definitely with a cracker.
We've got a statement here from Carl. Kieran recently took Doom Wheels and went 4-1. What a man. What a hero. This isn't a question, of course, just a statement of fact. But he does want to know if you can tell us more about your Doom Wheel adventures.
About the Doom Wheel adventures. So I was damn close to a 5-0. Damn close. that being said, so Doom Wheels. I originally thought, just like everyone else, that they were a bit of a meme. It is what it is. They did come down heavily in points. And it wasn't until I actually took a look at them and I was like, these are not the meme that people think they are. They're actually surprisingly good. So the main trick with Doom Wheels for anyone listening is with an engineer, you can double their movement. So it takes them from a 4d6 to 4d6 doubled, which gives them an average of 28 inches. sometimes you get like 15, 16. At one game at the GT, I got a 40-inch movement on the wheel, which was fucking hilarious. And then what you do is you load it with Levitate and you load it with two sources of Death Frenzy, and more warp power if you want, and you just lob it straight into the enemy lines. Now, whenever it finishes any move, you roll a dice for everyone within an inch, 2+, they take D3 mortals. So the reason why I took it was into KO, but it works really well into other armies. You put Levitate on it, you fly over their boat, everyone on board's taken D3 mortals, or 2+, right? So let's just say everyone's, for simplicity, everyone's taken D3. And then you charge into it, everyone takes D3, they unleash hell on you, they kill the wheel, you still get two pile-ins with Death Frenzies. So that means that you've done four moves. So the boat and everyone on it is taking, on average, 8 mortals. That's insane for like 160 points plus, you know, the 100-ish points for the engineer, and I've got two of the wheels. So for 200 points, it's basically launching like an 8 mortal wound bomb right into the center of the enemy army, which against something like KO, you will kill every single hero on that boat statistically and probably do a ton of damage to the boat, the thunderers, the engine riggers, everything. So they were put as a bit of a meme, and I do appreciate that their randomness is a pain in the ass. But again, when you're getting 4d6 doubled, pretty consistently, you're going to be hitting the mark. Now, one of the nice things that I'm praying for in a bit of a greedy way is I only just picked up the Doomwheels very late into this book, and not many people have ever run Doomwheels competitively. So I'm hoping that in the next GHB, it's too late and Games Workshop's going to bring the price of Doomwheels down, being like, no one runs Doomwheels. These things are crap. We want people to run these. And they're going to bring them down just in time for Doomwheels to actually be good as they are now. And then suddenly I can just like flood Doomwheels. So,
that's so good.
we'll see how it goes.
Everyone loves a good missile. It reminds me sort of like of a smash bat, not quite the mass damage, but the mortal wounds. And then I'm sure it's supposed to do some more damage with its actual attacks outside of the charging and piling in mortals.
Well, that's the great thing about it. Like, so in my game 4 at SAGT, I was up against hilariously the same Varangard list I played at Masters. On the same map I played at Masters.
Oh, wow.
And I asked the guy, did you watch my stream? And he said, no. And I'm like, well, then.
That's all I
proceeded. I proceeded to do the exact same thing. and I was like, coolies. So against his Varangard, the mortal wounds weren't that great. They actually have a decent shooting profile. So I just held them back when he charged the Varangard in. I just blasted them with two Doomwheels shooting at the Varangard pack. And then what you can do is you can blast. So you do two Doomwheels blasting with the sparks, which does a lot of damage. Then you charge both the wheels in. They do 4 mortals on average to 1 target. Then you fight with the Vermin Lord. The Master Clan pile activates, so they both get to pile around. That's another 4 mortals. And then when they activate, they get to move again. So another 4 mortals. So, you know, they get to both shoot and then do about 12 mortals in total from their movements to 1 target, which is... Again, for 360 points, that's bananas.
The joy of not having the normal move, fuck to them.
the only thing they are definitely weak to is getting shot at because they're horrendously squishy. That being said, the main armies that shoot at them at the moment are KO and Lumineth. But if I start with them far enough back, run up their movement, and just launch them across the board, they won't be shot at before they've managed to hit the opponent, unless the opponent, and this is the magic trick, the opponent has to take first an alpha into me if they want to stop the wheels. And if they're doing that, then one, they're not going to get the double. And two, they're now positioned right in front of me for Thankwall and Vermin Lord and everything else to then just come in and do their work, you know, all for sacrificing two wheels, which is not so bad.
And leaning all the way back to what you said at the start, having a turn one plan can take you to great success.
For sure, for sure.
We've got a few questions here from Gabe. Yep. Gay wants to know if you could rewrite one war scroll in the Skaven book, what would it be?
If I could rewrite one war scroll, I mean, easy. Rattling guns. It's not even a big rewrite. It's a tiny rewrite. I feel like a lot of the Skaven book, they wrote the book and they didn't really think about it and they didn't really test it. And they just said, here's your book. And then you would think they would just FAQ it afterwards, and they just never did. With the rattling guns, they used to have an overcharge where you roll 2 dice, and if you overcharge it, you get to double the number of shots. But if you rolled a double, it would blow up after it attacks, which means that 1 in 6 chance you're going to die after you shoot. In the new book, they changed it to 2d6 shots, but if you overcharge it, you get 4d6 shots. But if you roll a double, you die after you shoot. They didn't change the wording of that. But now you're rolling 4 dice. So they went from a 16% chance of you dying to an 80% chance of you dying. It's like, it wasn't like a small change. It was a huge change. I feel like it wasn't like before in the old book, rattling guns were dominating the meta and everyone was terrified of the rattling guns. But they just moved them into a unit that's like, now they're just kind of crap. And yes, I know that like, 3 out of the 4 Skaven lists at Masters took rattling guns. I know. Yes. they clearly have a place if people are taking them, but they're only taking them so they can fit into the one drop. That's the only reason why they're taking them. If they could take anything else and still fit into the one drop, they would. But yeah, so I would say rattling guns, it's my favorite unit. And I was very, very sad when they just neutered them going into the new book. I didn't think they needed the neutering. In fact, they actually tried to buff them, but made them worse accidentally. And they just never fixed it. And it's just very sad because I think there's nothing more Skaven than dudes with rattling guns popping out and just killing stuff.
Rattling guns was so much fun in the old book, especially throwing a spark on them. They're 2 damage each. Everyone goes, oh, Ross rolled 2 sixes. Well, there's your 24 shots with 2 damage each. It's just like, whoa.
What I would do in the old book is I would take a priest for curse, and I would take the general for reroll shooting for nearby weapon teams. So when you overcharge all of your guns, it'd be 12d6 shots, rerolling to hit with sixes doing mortal. So what's that? I think on average, 4d6 is 24. No, sorry, 4d6 is 24 shots, rerolling misses. So basically anything that's not a six. So if you think that's probably about 40 shots per rattling with sixes doing mortals. It was insane. Like you just hit a curse on something and just hit it for like 20 mortals. People are like, what? So, and that was like with 180 points of rattling guns, you would hit for like 20 mortals plus the regular damage with the spark coming through. You'd hit for like 60 damage with 3 rattlings.
The Skaven way.
Yeah, that's it. So that'd be the one for me, is the rattling gun. I think that needs it. That needs to be fixed up.
Mm-hmm. And then what model would you update as well?
What model would I update? I've got some really old models. I know people have their pet favorites of like the Rat Ogres and the Night Runners and stuff. What would I update as a model? Which one are you bastards?
It's the worst ugliest? Looking one. Which the one rattling are guns are very unique looking, but they also look like ass.
They're pretty bad, but they're almost so bad that they're in the like, I like how bad this is category. What would be the one to update?
I suppose if you could get the old Rat Ogres again. Where they're not those weird, stupid, shitty-looking current ones because they broke the mold or whatever happened to the mold.
Well, the only thing, so I've got the old, I've got all Island of Blood and the old Skaven Battalion Rat Ogres because I played them back in the day. My only gripe with it is I came back to the game and they were like, oh, by the way, Rat Ogres now have guns on their arms, and none of my Rat Ogres have guns. It's like, what? When do we suddenly start adding guns to these things? Okay, I'll give you my answer for this, and I can say this as a very definitive thing. It is the Hell Pit Abomination, because I have the print for one. I think the Hell Pit Abomination should like strike terror and fear. Like it's like people look at the one I've got and they're like, wow, this is huge. The actual Hell Pit Abomination is actually like this tiny little snake thing with like like it's surprisingly small and surprisingly like. Okay, like where I kind of like the Hell Pit striking fear, and I think I would have liked the Hell Pit almost to be more of like lots of Skaven like stitched together as like a almost like a Nurgle like unit.
Yes,
where at the moment it looks more like a Hydra than anything else, which is a bit weird.
It's supposed to be made in a pit of flesh. Like where's the pitness to it? It's just like a jumbling mound of a little bit of bits and pieces here and there, and that's about it. It doesn't really seem like a fleshy mound with chaos everywhere.
Yeah, I'd almost prefer it to be like, something almost Nurgle-like in nature. So I'd say the Hell Pit's probably my model of choice if it was to get remodeled.
Okay. And he's got one last one here for you. If you had a gnaw hole in your backyard big enough for you to climb through, where would the other two be?
Where would the other two be? Man, I don't even know. Probably Bendigo. The amount of times I have to freaking get out there, it's like the amount of times I have to get out there. It's a whole damn adventure. So I'd probably say, well, I've got to put one in Bendigo for some good tournaments. The other one, I'm someone I've needed to travel the world, but I never really have. You know what? I'm gonna controversial take. I'm gonna go Bendigo. And I had such a great time in Adelaide. I'm putting my other gnaw hole in Adelaide.
Okay.
great community out there. Great tournament. When I went out there, I took a 10-day holiday with my partner. We went to the wineries. We went to the zoos. They had lots of lovely like animal sanctuaries. The food was great. It's a city where I was on the beach and I was driving into the city and I was like, put in the GPS. Yep, that'll be a 13-minute drive. I'm like. What are we doing? 13 minutes for me in Melbourne. I'm in the CBD. I can't get to Fitzroy in 13 minutes. like even if I'm in a car, it takes me 15 minutes to get to the next suburb. I can cross Adelaide in 25. Like, you know? So I'm saying one's in Bendigo, one's in Adelaide. I'm sorry, Geelong, but I can drive there. So, Geelong's close enough. Bendigo's far enough that I'm a bit annoyed and I'd like a gnaw hole there for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Nathan Goodchild said you were good on stream. He really enjoyed your game or games because I think both of them are on stream with Terrence and also Dave.
Yeah, thank you. I I tried to make it explain. I tried to do what I could to stay out of the way and explain things where I could, but it is a bit of a tricky thing watching on stream for sure.
Yeah, I bet. And then the last one's Bogan of Sigmar, James. How do you think Skaven will fare outside of the current GHB? And how do you sort of think, without obviously knowing what's happening in the next GHB, how do you think they're going to fare in the future meta?
Yeah, I mean, look, Skaven's got such a wide book that no matter the meta, we're probably okay. I don't think we're ever going to be top of the meta. I don't think we're ever going to be like bottom of the meta dumpster trash. So it really depends. Like, I mean, let's say hypothetical. It's a wizard meta. Great. Let's say it's a infantry meta, like the GV one. Yeah, we did all right there. GCs, we did all right. I know people are saying the theory is that it might be a cavalry meta. While Skaven has no cavalry, I mean, technically, like Screaming Bell, Plague Furnace, Thankhall, sure, they're mounted, but they're not really cavalry. I'd love it if they arrived at the Doomwheel to be cavalry. That would be pretty sick. That being said, Skaven does incredibly well into cavalry because the main thing that cavalry is weak to is if it has to run into a chaff line, that's a terrible trade for cavalry. Cavalry wants to hit past the chaff line, killing the stuff behind it. Skaven's the best chaff army in the game. So if we go into a cavalry meta, I'm ready. If we go into a priest meta, I got priests, I got wizards, I got hordes, I got GCs, I could just run three vermin lords if it's the big boys meta. So I think Skaven will always be solid. That being said, it is a very squishy army, so it does take some tricks to use. So I think we're okay. Yeah, between Thankful, Vermin Lord, Clan Rats, and then just some assorted damage of your choice, we'll be all right in the next meta. We'll see how it goes and see if the Doom Wheels stick. And also,
Yeah.
if Games Workshop can bring those Doom Wheels down in price, like
Perfect. Take
that'd be
more of them.
golden.
Because they're not behemoths, are they?
They
Or
are.
they are, so
That,
you get
okay.
limited to
This
four.
is one of the crazy things about this game book. So get this right. One of the best sharpshooters in the game would have been Jezzails, but they're artillery. Long strikes are not artillery. Bolt boys are not artillery. Skaven are. In this game.
It's that's the classic where GW was just like, we'll just throw out a few little updates to the book and just toss it back into the ring again with no new
Yeah.
art, no new thought, nothing really changed at all about it. That's what really annoyed me about the whole book because I was quite an avid Skaven player before the new book
Yeah.
came out, and I was just like, oh, there's no thought originality here. There's a few neat tricks, but it
Yeah.
just annoyed me.
And similarly, Rattling Guns should have been the best sharpshooter in the game, in my opinion.
Rats
Because,
with machine guns.
what's better than just like a sharpshooting machine gun that just drops out? And on top of that, because they hide in a unit, you could run a one-drop Skaven army with sharpshooters because you can have three rattling guns and they don't count as drops. Yet you got sharpshooters, which is the main problem with being a one-drop army, is you don't have access to sharpshooters. But then they just shat the bed and and then they're just terrible. So the two sharpshooting units of Skaven both suck. And it's like, God damn it. So yeah, it's just, yeah, they are behemoths. So that being said, four Doomwheels would be plenty.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's when you get people starting to run like five and six of stuff, it's like, okay, you're starting to build like tilt lists that are gonna dominate one matchup and just get smacked down another. So I think a third Doomwheel would be nice. If I can squeeze one more in, that would be ideal.
I remember trying to play with them in the old book where they had didn't have the correct wording, so you could get like all that extra move out of it. And I think it was like Thrings something, and you could just get them to move the 48 inches constantly. It was so much fun to play around with them all.
Yeah, there's definitely some broken stuff in the Skaven book that needs to be patched up and FAQ'd. There was broken stuff in the old book. There's still broken stuff in the new book. And I would like it if they just spent, 5 minutes just clarifying some of these things. But that would be it's a big ask. I'm hoping with the release of Old World, given that Skaven is one of the biggest IPs for Games Workshops, if they're listening. With everyone loves them in Total War, it's a big, Vermintide, the video game. So with Old World coming out, I'm hoping there's going to be some new Skaven stuff, and then maybe they'll introduce the Skaven AOS book at the same time as Old World and have a big old rat party. But
Very
we'll see.
fun. Yeah. So what's next for you in the coming months then? What tournaments you got planned? Or you got anything outside of tournaments planned?
So tournaments planned. Taking a little bit of a break. By a little bit of break, I only mean like a few months. So we just finished SAGT, I think, and that's more just mainly taking a break because there were no tournaments for the next few months. I don't know what happened in Victoria. Everyone just missed a period of time somehow. I know there is a teams tournament coming up. I may be roped into it. I'll see, but it's a little bit tricky. Next big tournaments coming up are Lost Legion. I believe it's Death and Riches. So I'll be there for that. And I've already told Nathan every tournament I've been to, I've never seen a Skaven prize yet. All right. So there better be Skaven prizes somewhere in there. So Death and Riches. Then we've got I will be flying up for Sydney GT. My family's all in Sydney, so it's a nice excuse for me to go visit some family. And I was like, oh, PS, by the way, I'm here to play Warhammer. Yes, I'll see you. I'll see you in the meanwhile if you would like.
Not on the weekends. I'll see you outside the weekend.
I'll see you Friday night as I fly in and Sunday night as I fly out. So we got that. And then there's also another one coming up in Lynbrook, which is a score to settle. So three GTs pretty close to each other. The nice thing is all of them are going to be most likely after the GHB release. So my brain doesn't need to be fully active on list building right now until I know definitively what we're working with. So for now, there's a few one days coming up. I'm probably just going to run Doom Wheels. They're fun. I'm not convinced that the Doom Wheels are better than my old Hell Pits and Plague Sensor Bearers list, but it is fucking hilarious. So I'm probably just going to run out the Doom Wheels for the rest of the clock, wait for the next GHB, see what gets nerfed, buffed, changed around, see what the meta focus is, and then I'll rebuild my list accordingly for those tournaments, and go take on Nathan. And he's been dodging me the whole bloody time.
Sounds
like
grudges that need to be settled there, Nathan.
He beat the crap out of me once, and then he's run away.
Need that revenge.
That's it. So we'll get there. We'll get there.
Is there anything you wanted to leave the listeners with? Words of wisdom or thoughts?
Words of wisdom or thoughts? I mean, look, just probably the main thing is just to enjoy yourself while you're playing the game. I see a lot of people who take the game very, very seriously. At the end of the day, we're all here to enjoy the game. It's something I have learned very heavily off the master. One of my mates, Will, who very, very good player at the game and just doesn't take it that seriously. And not trying to be a bit funny about this, but I've seen him just walk from tournaments. Just like the man can win. He's just like, yeah, I just wanted to explore the gardens nearby and go to the restaurant instead. Like, why don't we all just do that? Like, that just sounds so much better. Like, when you're not enjoying it, just enjoy yourself. Like, the words of wisdom, my God. So just enjoy it after each match. Ask your opponent, like, what do you think I could have done better? Was there anything particularly you think I did that was, you know, stupid or vulnerable or anything like that? Learn from your games. Don't beat yourself up. And, enjoy yourself and grab a beer with the opponent afterwards and just keep going.
Beautiful.
That's probably the best advice. And don't care too much about painting. I'm not much of a painter. Some people are like, oh, I can't play a tournament because my army's not looking good. It's like, just... It's all right. My army looks worse than yours. Trust me. Everyone who's played me, my Vermin Lord is always off his base. The arms are off. The magnets are everywhere. Bits are broken. Clan rats are lying down. It's fine. Just enjoy the game.
And then did you have any shout-outs?
Any shout-outs? Oh, I mean, all the clubs. Oh, look, probably main shout-out is just my partner who was behind there before. Oh, these are some of her lovely artworks. For those who know her, she pretty much turns up to every – I think she has turned up to every tournament with me.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite a lot. I think I've now been to like 10, 11 GTs, right, which is a lot of tournaments. That being said, I guess my shout-out is in this case not to Joe but actually to the community as a whole because – the reason why she keeps turning up to 10 or 11 tournaments is because she has a great time too.
Oh, that's good.
She's got lots of friends in the community who, you know, she has a great time. She loves going out for drinks and going for the food afterwards and just having a great old time. So, thank you to the community for babysitting Joe while I have to play some water at the table. Just for welcoming into AOS and hopefully we'll... I'll be here for a little while longer and hopefully requalify for next year's Masters. If I don't get a 5-0, I may not make it again. I might be 25th and then not get enough dropouts and I won't make it. So I better get cracking and actually win something for once.
Right? Get a shot to a tournament for once.
So We'll see. But yeah, that's probably the best shout out as such. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Kieran. I greatly appreciated you making the time. And it was good chat with you.
No problem. And hopefully I'll see you around at some of the other tournaments around too.
Indeed. Have a good one.
Easy.
Thank you for listening to Unidentified Wargamer. You can find links for the guests located in the description below. You can find the show on Twitter at @u_wargamer. And I will see you next week.